As a young person coming into this, there was one thing I recognized, that I was walking in the shadow of giants, and John is definitely a giant.
A dedication to an icon of the Arctic, Kotzebue's John Schaefer. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, August 10th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, celebrating the first official Alaska Salmon Day.
Tell me what you're eating.
Fish.
What kind of fish?
Smoked salmon, because it's so juicy.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you've earned some college credits but haven't yet completed your degree, finish it now, online from anywhere. Online learning at University of Alaska Southeast provides courses in a format that is flexible for students working and raising families. Admission deadlines have been extended to August 19th. Apply now. Go to finishcollege.alaska.edu for more information. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
Yesterday, the Alaska National Guard officially dedicated a giant helicopter hangar in Kotzebue to the country's first Inupiaq two-star general. Major General John W. Schaefer, Jr. was head of Alaska's National Guard when the Exxon Valdez spill happened, and Schaefer played a critical role in the state's response. But before that, he was instrumental in fighting for the people of the Northwest Arctic at a pivotal time. Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports.
Well, welcome back to KOTZ in Kotzebue. And what's on the agenda for today?
Well, it's a full agenda.
Amid all the hubbub in Kotzebue, Governor Bill Walker stopped to chat with radio host Johnson Green about the day's big affair.
The main event is a dedication to John Schaefer.
The National Guard is naming a building after Schaefer. It's an enormous aviation hangar a little ways out of town that houses two huge helicopters owned by the Coast Guard, which is expanding its presence in the Arctic. And dedicating a building can seem like kind of a small thing, but that is just not the case here in Kotzebue.
Let's look to God.
Willie Goodwin reads an invocation in Inupiaq to more than 200 people, elders and Schaefer family members filling every available seat, with military personnel and dignitaries lining the walls. Ahead of speeches, the Northern Lights dancers drum just a few feet away from where Major General Schaefer sits beside an enormous orange helicopter. Schaefer is in declining health and isn't able to speak. As leaders from across the region and the state give remarks, it's as much to the dozens of Schaefer family members as to the man himself. Reggie Jewell is a former legislator and recently stepped down as mayor of the Northwest Arctic Borough. He drew tears from the crowd, recounting Schaefer's legacy.
As a young person coming into this, there was one thing I recognized, that I was walking in the shadow of giants. And John is definitely a giant.
Though the dedication nominally focuses on Schaefer's military career, the day overall is a deep dive into how critical a part he played building the Alaska of today, particularly in rural regions. Many of the economic, cultural, and governmental institutions that impact people's day-to-day lives started in John and Martha Schaefer's home during the 60s. And Jewell says that was happening at a crucial time in the formation of a political Alaska Native identity.
Some of the things that happened was we begin to see the good of being an Inupiaq person, that we had worth, that we were equal to all others, that we could walk alongside of them, not in front or in back.
Schaefer was a leader as a hard political battle was being fought in advance of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. And one of that effort's architects, Willie Hensley, says his nephew John stepped up at a time when decades of oppressive policies had put Inupiaq cultural and political power under serious threat. Hensley drafted Schaefer into the political fight while they were still in their 20s, resulting, he says, in Inupiaq values becoming the starting point for organizations like NANA, the school district, and the Northwest Arctic Borough.
We worked hand in glove on what we call Inupiaq Ilitqset, that is, using our traditional values as the foundation, you know, of not only our individual lives, but the reason for our institutions that we worked with.
The rural character of Alaska's enduring institutions doesn't end in the bush. Adjutant General Lori Hummel now leads the Alaska National Guard, just as Schaefer did, and she says this dedication is about recognizing the values from rural Alaska baked into the Guard.
We are proud of his heritage, and we're proud of our heritage because the Alaska National Guard's roots come from the Territorial Guard. And the Alaska Territorial Guard was rural-based, it was community-based, it was the ultimate force of citizen soldiers.
Many of the Inupiaq values Schaefer brought to bear on the Guard relate to family and community, and that legacy is clear in the dozens of family members gathered at the hangar and the potluck afterwards, including Martha Schaefer, John's wife of nearly 57 years.
We were both born and raised here in Kotzebue. We had our fun times in high school and then got back together after high school.
The couple's early years were at a time when the wives of guardsmen helped carry out essential duties, and Martha recalls carrying her young babies in a sled to Kotzebue's old armory to make radio calls. Likewise, the Schaefer's role in ANCSA was a family affair.
A lot of the work that was done in my kitchen, pretty much.
John's health has worsened in the last few weeks since a bout of pneumonia and a series of small strokes. But Martha Schaefer says she's grateful he's alive to see his legacy honored.
Because most of the time when dedications or things are named, it's usually after a person passes. And I think John understood what was happening today because he opened his eyes and perked up a couple of times when he heard the national anthem. I'm thankful that you know, he was able to at least attend the dedication, and thank everybody for showing up.
With the doors open, the hangar looks out over Kotzebue, the sea, and the lands all around. In Kotzebue, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
State legislators who aren't running for re-election have created openings drawing big spending ahead of the primary election next Tuesday. A quarter of all spending by legislative candidates has been in just three races for open seats, but it's not clear whether those who've spent the most will be able to convert that into votes. Andrew Kitchenman of APRN and KTOO in Juneau reports.
The races to replace Anchorage Republican Liesl McGuire and Democrat Johnny Ellis in the Senate have drawn the most spending this year. Republicans Natasha von Imhoff, Representative Craig Johnson, and Jeff Landfield are running to replace McGuire. Von Imhoff has spent more than any other candidate this year, $131,000. Von Imhoff notes that she's been able to draw financial support from many individual donors. She attributes that to both her positions on putting state spending on a sustainable footing and the contact she's had with many Alaskans through her work on the Rasmussen Foundation Board and through commercial lending.
I have visited many of the industries that fuel our state's economy, including visiting mines. I've been on oil rigs. I have been on cruise ships, fishing vessels. I've seen the timber industry at work.
Through Tuesday, her campaign spent twice as much as Johnson and Landfield combined. While Johnson says spending is always a concern, he feels good based on face-to-face contact with constituents.
As I go door to door, I haven't, seen the negatives, and quite frankly, I haven't seen $130,000 worth of spending out of Natasha. We've got a week left, and I don't know where she spent her money.
Johnson added that there will still be plenty of spending in the next week, so the snapshot of spending through yesterday is incomplete. Landfield says he's spending his money more efficiently than the other two candidates.
I have my Make Alaska Great Again hats, which are, you know, kind of a Trump parody gimmick, and people love those. And I got these really unique signs up in Anchorage that are very different. I mean, everything about my campaign is different. So I can spend a dollar, and for Craig or Natasha, especially Natasha, they have to spend probably five.
The second most expensive race is between Democrats Tom Begich and Ed Wesley to replace Senator Johnny Ellis. Begich says his many years of community involvement led to individuals contributing to his campaign.
Many of those are folks that have not given at all in the past and have worked with me on whether it's neighborhood work or whether it's some of the justice work I've done or just the general work I've done in communities in the past.
Wesley is concerned about the amount of spending in the primary. He spent the seventh most of any statehouse candidate, but only a little more than half of his opponent, Begich. He says he's turned down money from labor unions and other groups.
Special interest money has created fear and greed in the legislature. and has an undue influence on our legislature.
The Republican primary race to replace Anchorage Representative Mike Hawker is the fourth most expensive race. That race pits Ross Beeling against Jennifer Johnston. Other expensive primary races have major implications for the future of state finances. The third most expensive race is the Republican primary between Representative Jim Culver and challenger George Rauscher, both of Palmer. The Culver-Rauscher race has been at the center of more than a third of all independent expenditures in favor or opposing candidates this year. This spending is fueled by labor unions and corporations. When independent expenditures are added to campaign spending, the challenger Rauscher has benefited more than the incumbent Culver. Overall campaign spending on legislative races is up slightly from the same point in the last election, when the race for governor was at the top of the ballot. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaska's Democratic Party is campaigning against two of their own lawmakers, including Barrow's Benny Nagyak.
I am a voice that won't be stopped.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Democrats are hoping to take control of the state house this year. To achieve that, they're gunning for two lawmakers who run as Democrats, but largely vote with the Republicans. One is Representative Benny Nagyak, who represents District 40, which stretches from Kotzebue to Koktovik. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rachel Waldholtz reports.
In early August, a who's who of Alaska Democrats gathered at the home of oil and gas attorney Robin Brenna for a fundraiser. There was a pile of shoes by the door, and guests mingled in their socks with former U.S. Senator Mark Begich, among others. That show of Democratic solidarity and support, it was aimed at unseating two of their own, incumbent state lawmakers Bob Herron of Bethel and Benjamin Nagyak of Barrow. Both lawmakers caucus with the Republican majority in the state legislature, and it's clear their colleagues are fed up. Here's Democratic leader Chris Tuck quoting Anchorage Republican Lance Pruitt.
I mean, we had Representative Pruitt say that, you know, one of the best Republican members that they have is Ben Nagyak. And, you know, I just want to have more Democrats, real true Democrats, in the state house.
Nagyak's challenger is Dean Westlake of Kotzebue, who says he's running to make sure rural Alaska has a voice in the Capitol.
There are a lot of us dissatisfied because the values that we have are not the ones that we see down in Juneau.
Westlake is the director of Village Economic Development for NANA, the regional native corporation for Northwest Alaska. He ran against Nagyak 2 years ago, losing by just 131 votes. This time, running with the explicit and financial backing of the Democratic Party, he has high hopes. If elected, Westlake says he'd prioritize rural education and community revenue sharing, and he proposes working harder to bring federal money into Alaska villages at a time when state funding for things like water and sewer projects is disappearing.
One of the our values is you always take care of the least of us. And as a representative, that's what I'd have to do. It means I'm going to, you know, whoever takes this job, you absolutely have to work with whoever is out there, whether they're regardless of party affiliation.
The man he's challenging says the Arctic already has a strong voice in Juneau. His.
As you probably know, I am a voice that won't be stopped. And they're trying to stop me from doing the work I've done for the past 40 years.
Nagyak is a former North Slope borough mayor and assemblyman. He's running for his third term in the state house. He's co-chair of the House Resources Committee, and he's known in Juneau for passionate floor speeches, often in defense of resource development and its importance to North Slope communities. In the fight over oil taxes this year, his committee rolled back Governor Bill Walker's proposal to severely limit tax credits for oil companies. Nagyak is unapologetic about his support for the industry.
99% of the oil and tax revenues that we get not only here in the North Slope Borough, and but from the state, comes from oil and gas taxes. Period.
That's a slight exaggeration, though in the years before oil prices fell, the state was getting up to 90% of general fund revenue from oil. Nagyak says he's disappointed the legislature couldn't come up with a long-term budget solution this session, and he blames the gridlock, at least in part, on minority Democrats. But he says he'd be happy to join a Democrat-led majority if one materializes.
So if you could be part of the majority, you would definitely join it.
Well, who wouldn't?
The point, he says, is to be in the majority. He points to a provision he passed in 2014 which lifted the cap on how much oil revenue the North Slope Borough could devote to government operations, a longtime goal for the region that he says he couldn't have achieved in the minority. One of Nagyak's allies in that fight, then Borough Mayor Charlotte Brower, who has since been recalled over the misuse of public money. Nagyak defended her during the recall effort this spring, a position that might affect his standing with Barrow voters. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage.
Another race where the Democratic Party is trying to oust one of its own candidates is in House District 38. It's one of the most Democratic districts in the state, encompassing Bethel, the lower Kuskokwim River, and several coastal villages. There's no Republican challenger, so like District 40, the race will be decided in next week's primary. And both of the candidates claim they're the real Democrat in the race. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney has more.
If you had to put the two Bethel House candidates somewhere on the political spectrum, they'd both be Democrats, but maybe with a lowercase d. Each accuses the other of not being Democratic enough. The incumbent, Bob Herron, is running for his fifth term in the legislature. He says he's been registered as a Democrat since the 70s, but he votes with the Republican-controlled majority in the House. He's even joined the Republican leadership team. Herron says party affiliation doesn't mean as much in rural parts of the state as it does in urban areas.
When you live in Western Alaska, people vote for the person, not necessarily the party.
But his party has had enough. In an unusual move, state Democrats have thrown their support behind a challenger, Zach Fansler. Democrats are hoping to build a bipartisan coalition in the House, and they see District 38 as key to that effort. Fansler, meanwhile, wasn't even registered as a Democrat. He changed his party affiliation the day he filed to be a candidate. He was either nonpartisan or undeclared. He says he doesn't remember which. Fansler says his liberal values align with the Democratic platform and better reflect the district.
I've always been the kind of person that has been kind of independent. It always worried me when we see the exact situation that's played out. You join a caucus, and all of a sudden you are forced to do what they want you to do.
The district includes more than 30 far-flung communities, from Nunavak Island in the Bering Sea to Russian Mission on the Yukon River and the regional hub, Bethel. It has major challenges. It's among the poorest districts in the state, and students in its schools are some of the lowest performing on the state's annual exams. Herron has a long history in the region. A former Marine, he served as Bethel's city manager and was a legislative aide for more than a decade. Herron says the best way to represent the district is to join the majority.
Historically, rural legislators join whatever majority is, Democratic-led or Republican-led. And so by joining it, you have a better chance of protecting your constituents.
Herron says communities in his district have seen more than $600 million in capital project funds during his time as a legislator, and programs like power cost equalization would have been harder to defend outside of the majority. But Fansler says Herron has put the caucus above his district. Fansler is an attorney and a former race manager for the Kuskokwim 300 sled dog race. He's currently a city council member in Bethel and works as the development director at Bethel's public radio station, KYUK. He says, if elected, he'll vote differently, particularly when it comes to what gets cut during tough fiscal times.
One, I won't be in a Republican majority. So anytime there's an amendment that comes forward that says, hey, let's restore this funding to Head Start, my vote would be yes, let's do that, not no, which is what the incumbent did. If there's a restoration of funding to VPSO programs or to trooper dispatches? My vote's going to be yes, not no.
The list goes on. Fansler says he'd vote to keep money in the state's revenue sharing program, which helps communities fund basic services.
If there's a vote to have other revenue streams.
That's code for new taxes.
My vote's going to be yes, not no. Conversely, when it comes to oil tax credits, I'm not going to vote no time and time and time again to rolling those back.
Fansler is targeting one vote in particular. Herron supported the legislature's lawsuit challenging Governor Bill Walker's decision to expand Medicaid, which offers health insurance to low-income Alaskans. Herron says that vote wasn't about rejecting the expansion. It was about what he considers an overreach of the governor's power. But the two do agree on some things. Both say Walker's budget veto that capped the permanent fund dividend checks at $1,000 this year will have a disproportionate impact on the state's rural residents. And both are opposed to a statewide sales tax, but say an income tax would spread the burden of paying for state government more evenly. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, I'm Rasha McChesney.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future that delivers oil today and sustains operations for tomorrow.
If you've earned some college credits but haven't yet completed your degree, finish it now, online from anywhere. Online learning at University of Alaska Southeast provides courses in a format that is flexible for students working and raising families. Admission deadlines have been extended to August 19th. Apply now. Go to finishcollege.alaska.edu for more information. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
A Tooloksac man remains missing. 43-year-old Walter Hawk walked away from his village almost a full month ago. Tooloksac Search and Rescue last spotted him over the weekend, about 10 miles upriver from the village. Search and Rescue member Nelson Napolka says when Hawk saw the boat and heard the group shouting his name, he ran away. Search and Rescue has seen Hawk several times since he left town, but each time he's disappeared before they could reach him. As of today, he's been missing 28 days. Napolka says when the search team last spotted Hawk, he was wearing the same blue sweater he'd left town in, and though he looked dirty, he did not appear sick or injured. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is wrapping up its work on Attu, at least for now. This summer, the Corps spent about a month and a half camped out on the uninhabited westernmost island in the Aleutian Chain. The mission was environmental. The Corps worked to clean up two World War II-era military sites that were leaking tar and petroleum, contaminating the soil and entrapping seabirds living on the island. The $10 million project is part of the formerly used defense sites program. Project manager Andy Sorum says the environmental risks on Attu have been on the Corps' radar for nearly a decade.
In the case of Attu, we had 52 above-ground storage tanks that were about 4,000 gallons each, and they had deposited about an acre and a half a surface tar that was still really sticky and entrapped birds. It was an acute hazard.
When the bulk of the fieldwork was finished in mid-July, the Corps and its local contractor had removed about 10,000 tons of soil contaminated by petroleum, oil, and lead, along with 70 tons of tar drums and 52 massive storage tanks. While the Corps accomplished its major goals on the island, Sorum says there's still more work to be done. Today, August 10th, the state is celebrating its first ever Alaska Wild Salmon Day. Alaska Public Media's Graylin Brashear went out to one local cookout marking the occasion.
Lyra Obruska is parked on a curb in a tented parking lot across from the Bristol Bay Native Corporation headquarters in Anchorage, clutching a paper plate with just one thing on it.
Tell me what you're eating.
Fish!
What kind of fish?
Smoked salmon, because it's so juicy.
She's here with her family for a community fish bake put on by the Bristol Bay Corporation in honor of the first official Alaska Wild Salmon Day. The day of celebration was created by the legislature back in May and is being marked Wednesday with cookouts and community events across the state. It's a feel-good day to recognize a fish that means many things to Alaskans, says Bryce Edgman, the Dillingham representative who sponsored the bill creating the special day. But it's also about reminding Alaskans that salmon is critical to the state and its people, and is a resource that needs protecting.
Being from Bristol Bay and all the challenges we've had with keeping our salmon ecosystem intact, that was a very important component of the bill, and we got a lot of support for it.
At the cookout, the mood was one of appreciation. Out of the hundreds of people who came to fill their plates, many grew up fishing on Bristol Bay, and they had a lot to say about what that means to them.
Salmon, it's a way of life. It's I've been eating it for 70 years, so it hasn't failed me yet. It's good for you.
We live on it and all summer long and all winter long. In the summer, we put away fish, make strips and dry fish and pressure cook, and I jar them for the whole winter.
Down in Virginia, they charge $36 a pound for salmon. And I had to go buy 1 pound just so I could have some while I was there babysitting my grandsons. My mom started us fishing when we were like 5 and 6 years old, and we'd haul the fish up the beach one at a time. And we felt like we were so big and so strong. Fishing just helped us to realize how life continues to go on. You know, it's a renewal. It's a resource. It's something that will always be there, we hope.
There you heard the voices of Wayne Schroeder, Suzanne Chaitluk-Lovell, and Marianne Jones. If you're in Anchorage and you missed the cookout today, don't worry. You still have time to make it to another salmon party. The Alaska Center is hosting a barbecue from 5:30 to 8 p.m. at Cuddy Midtown Park. You'll be in good company. People are celebrating salmon today in Dillingham, Neck Neck, and other communities across Alaska. In Anchorage, I'm Graylin Brashear.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes in Kotzebue, Andrew Kitchenman and Rasha McChesney in Juneau, Rachel Waldholtz and Graylin Brashear in Anchorage, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, and Sarah Hansen in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org, where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety. It's summer and time to get out on the water, whether you're commercial fishing, heading to a weekend cabin, or tossing in a line to catch tonight's dinner. Having a boat means regular maintenance projects, fueling, and cleaning. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to minimize waste and pollution during these activities. Ask your harbor master for waste disposal information. Find more at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.